I think in some ways I should have been in the last session and Carol should have been in this session because we already broached the environment and I'm not going to be talking about it much. What I really want to stress is the idea that we've tended to think of deindustrialization as an established fact in the 19th century, which I think is basically incorrect. I think there is a really interesting question which remains, which is there was industrialization everywhere in the world, but could it have been greater? This is, to my mind, is a much more interesting question than the deindustrialization one. Jean Batou, when I said this to him in Lausanne, got really annoyed with me, and this is kind of old style dependency theory idea of deindustrialization. I think there is a sense that the West may have prevented the creation of modern industry, and the question is, does it do it through colonialism? Does it do it through soft power? And Kaoru, of course, has shown that writing the rules of the game doesn't always go the way you expect it, and that in many ways free trade in Asia benefited Japan much more than it benefited those who wrote those rules. But this is the soft power model. Now, what do I mean by industry? I got caught out with this by Maxine Berg, who I think, not sure she's here, but I gave a version of this paper in Warwick. And so I'm not sure that I've got a good definition. I think these three ideas, we talked about energy already, machinery, factories. The trouble is that these things you can find in different combinations at different times in different places. I'm doing a case study of the Philippines, trying to look at industrialization in the late Spanish period in the 19th century. And I've tried to use installed horsepower as a kind of rough index. But the trouble is that even the Americans, with their efficient census of 1902-3, they asked the question to everybody, and roughly half or more of the people didn't answer the question. So we don't have what I hoped would be a kind of benchmark of the end of the Spanish period. This is what we all expect factories to look like, or modern industry to look like, and of course, half the time, it doesn't. Then there's been a sort of recent shift from the kind of Jean Batou-type dependency theory to Geoffrey Williamson, who's arguing it's not really imperialism, whether soft or hard, it's really free trade, because the terms of trade favoured raw materials, labour moved into that sector. I think that's true, that's quite a good point. But then he argues that that involves lower skills, lower productivity, and higher price volatility. So this is his book. I think we've spoken a little bit about books which engender debate, but which are not terribly good. I would say this is in that category. I quite strongly disagree with virtually everything he says, but it's quite a provocative book. And here's Jeff himself, who, of course, has taken part in some of our deliberations organised by Patrick. So problems with Jeff's thesis. One of them which I'd like to encourage people to look at more is the question of futures markets. A lot of the price volatility is hedged by the emergence of futures markets. And of course, it's true that direct producers don't often have access, particularly peasants. Nevertheless, the people who they sell to, the merchants, do have access to futures markets. And the question of volatility then is, I think, more complicated than Williamson says. I also think that the labour productivity thing is a chicken and egg problem. I think in many ways there is low productivity in the global south, but is it a result of moving into primary production, or is it a cause of, I mean, is there are there other causes, rather, which lower productivity? We all know about stinginess of colonialism, but one of the things which I've been struck by in my own work is how colonialism was actually quite often less stingy in the provision of public goods than independent states. I've done a comparison between the Gold Coast, or modern Ghana, and Bahia in Brazil, and my God, the Bahian authorities were a lot stingier than the Gold Coast authorities in terms of providing anything at all for the taxes that they screwed out of the cocoa producers. Oops, sorry, wrong one. So this is a monument to the first known futures market in rice futures market in Japan, surprisingly early in many ways, end of the 17th century. There is a slight countervailing current, and I'm a great fan of Ken Pomerantz's not The Great Divergence, but The Pacific in the Age of Early Industrialization, which is an edited collection by Ken, which I think actually is a very good set of studies showing how you get industrialization occurring right around the world from the early 19th century. This is the book itself with a very unexciting Routledge cover, which Routledge seems to specialise in. So one sort of strand of this is the question of artisans. And we all know the idea that artisans are ruined. Karl Marx's famous statement. Of course, Karl Marx had never been to India, so he didn't see the bones of the cotton weavers. But this is the sort of person we're talking about. And if you put in deindustrialization, if you type it into the internet, this is the image that springs up. So they've gone from producing cotton cloth, and being the workshop of the world, to producing raw cotton. Note that this cotton is almost certainly industrially baled, right? So it's actually a very bad illustration of the idea that you get a complete wipeout. In fact, as Tirthankar, of course, has very famously shown, artisans don't disappear. And this is also true elsewhere. So this is Tirthankar's book, which I think is an extremely important milestone in this. But we've got other ones. We've spoken very little about the Middle East at this conference. I think it's been unfortunate the Middle East has been largely left out. But we get a similar process shown by Suraya Farooqi, by Parviz Mohebbi for Iran. Again, very important and very underused book because he wrote in French. And nowadays, French is no longer really much of a scholarly language. And most recently, this author has been quoted earlier for something else, but this has just come out on the history of Qing crafts. Note crafts. That's a fairly loaded word in its own right. Now, it's undoubtedly the fact that some artisans were negatively affected, but of course the point is that weavers actually benefited from the rise of cheap, reliable, factory-made thread. So we get a kind of dual situation where spinning goes backwards, but weaving develops. Much less known, I think, is the fact that dyers and embroiderers benefited from the creation of cheap factory-made cloth. I've looked at this for batik, for instance, and for embroidery, batik in Indonesia and embroidery in the Middle East, and we get exactly the same pattern. And most interesting of all, I think, in Tirthankar's book is the idea that certain artisans turn into industrialists slowly by a kind of process of osmosis. And I think his case study of the brass in Moradabad near Delhi, this is one of these workshops which, you know, looks very kind of traditional, but the fascinating thing is that they invest in machinery, in energy, and, you know, become really, particularly in the Second World War, become really important industrialists. We also tend to underestimate the industrialization of services because we always think that we have to be talking about tangible goods. But in fact, what we find is the service sector from the 19th century diverges quite strongly. Bits of the service sector become very highly industrialized. And the repair and maintenance workshops for this newly industrialized services, transport services, very often turn into industrial enterprises over time. I think it's how Dick has looked at this for Indonesia, where you get the shift from repair and maintenance into manufacturing. This is, you know, fairly obvious pictures, although this one's interesting because this is a railway which had very little economic benefit. This was really to justify the Ottoman Sultan continuing as the Khalifa of the faithful. This is, of course, a service sector which is very slow to industrialise. Nowadays it has industrialised, but you could argue that it's a very retarder kind of sector. But the thing I'm most interested in is the export substitution industrialisation through the processing of so-called raw materials. And I think this is one of the areas where we've got to be really careful with our language. We use this term raw materials all the time, and yet if you look at them, they're often not very raw at all. And they're increasingly less raw. So that all this emphasis on finished consumer goods, I think, needs to be thrown out of the window. That's not really what's important at the beginning of the 19th century. It's the adding of value through industrial investment in so-called raw materials, sometimes also industrially extracted. This is an early photograph of gold mines in South Africa where industrialization is going to the actual extraction process. But most of the time, so South Africa, again, the industrialization is occurring at the processing stage, the extraction of gold from the ore. So we get all sorts of reasons, perhaps, for this industrialization to occur, some of which are technical, and therefore they're said not to change the argument. You have to process stuff because it spoils, right? I've worked on a number of different commodities where if you don't process them quickly, they basically either rot completely, like meat and fish, or they become less effective in whatever they're meant to be doing. Also to save transport costs. Certain materials are very expensive to transport, and if you process them at source, you actually reduce your transport costs very considerably. This is quite an interesting picture. This is from Victor Bulmer Thomas's history, where we get the real factory in the field, the sugar factory in the field. And of course, with the locomotive in front, and Cuba is one of the most precocious areas in the world in the adoption of new industrialized transport services, which I think is often forgotten, but which John Curry Machado, for instance, has. This is sugarcane grinding. You can see how sugarcane really is a factory in the field. Sugar packing. This is in colonial Taiwan. The Japanese, as we heard earlier, developed sugar. This is a very interesting picture of a tea loft factory. I think this is in Java, although I haven't actually been able to. You can see the steam machinery right at the front, but a lot of this is actually not machine-based industry. It's actually just providing loads of rooms in which you can do various things to the tea leaf. This is a modern example from Mozambique, cashew processing, and meat and fish, I think, often forgotten in this kind of non-spoiling. Now, we've got a real problem with statistics, I think. One of the reasons why some of this has gone unnoticed is that customs services right around the world tend to be quite conservative in their labelling of certain categories of goods. And once these are established, they tend to go on forever. Although, to be fair to customs authorities, they often introduced various footnotes and various subdivisions, which historians have rather cavalierly, I think, ignored. So this is Spanish import statistics, in which you get a really interesting, oh, you can't see it very well, sorry, it's a bad photograph. But azúcar de Cuba is, that's a highly processed, highly industrially processed good. And then we have cacao and grano, which is virtually unprocessed. And the two are put in exactly the same category within those Spanish import statistics in 1898. This is another one of my famous examples, silk reeling factory in Japan. The product of this, which I think is silk yarn, is always, always called raw silk. There's nothing raw about this at all. I mean, this really is a crazy piece of labelling, but really quite reputable historians have fallen into this trap of calling this raw silk. It's not raw. We have a real problem, which I'd be really glad of getting some help with, which is why the same commodity is processed to differing degrees in different places. I think there's a number of possible reasons for this. I don't think distance to markets, which has been put forward, is actually very important. But I think the available factors of production for setting up modern factory industry are probably much more important. To some extent, colonies of rich or poor countries are important, and this has to do with the degree of protectionism. So I've given you the example here. This is cassiterite sand, which is exported as such from the Jos Plateau in Nigeria instead of making it into tin. This is tin smelting in Australia. You can see what large-scale industrial process this involves. Another example, this is from Belize, where you're doing all the fashioning of the timber by hand. This is a Japanese electric sawmill in East Sumatra in exactly the same period, where you get a really high degree of mechanization and, interestingly, the use of electricity. Indonesia is actually quite a pioneer in the use of electricity for manufacturing for reasons which are not entirely clear. So one of the reasons for this then, particularly in poorer and more backward metropoles, is that workers try to stop colonial processing to save their jobs at home. Senegalese groundnuts are a good example of this. You can't press them into oil in Dakar because the workers in Marseille want to keep their jobs. So here we have the groundnuts ready for export in Rufisque, and this is an early 19th century Marseille soap factory. Interestingly, of course, moving from olive oil used to be the reason why there was soap manufacturing in this area, to imported colonial groundnuts. So this export substitution industrialization then, I think, is hugely benefited by free trade. The real economies of scale for the world market. Australia succeeds essentially on wool. Japan, as we heard earlier, essentially on tea and silk. A better process than their Chinese rivals. I was interested to hear from Kairu that this was largely with firewood and charcoal, which I didn't know. This is the early stages of Japanese manufacturing. This is a tea factory in Japan. and tea labels. This is tea labels showing that some of the markets for Japanese tea were in North Africa, which is something I'm working on at the moment. Consumer goods, I think, are more affects the sum consumer goods industrialization from the early 19th century, but it's unusual. The Indian case, which is ignored by Williamson, is largely the story of Indian yarn replacing British yarn in the Indian Ocean and Chinese sea markets, of course, being then replaced by Japanese yarn in its turn. Early textile mill in India. A certain amount of pretty uncompetitive consumer goods in ISI pushed through by settlers, example from South Africa. And then we get the second period, which Williamson sees as a more positive period for industrialization, which I think in many ways is a much more negative period when free trade collapses and nationalism becomes obsessed with import substitution, industrialization of consumer goods, Kwame Nkrumah and the Gold Coast being a very good example of this. What we get then is a very poor quality industry. It's poorly planned, poorly coordinated, badly integrated with artisans, very badly sited. This is Hirschlag has some of the best critiques of particularly Turkish citing of import substitution and industrialization, which is just mind-bogglingly crazy. And of course, we get beggar my neighbor policies, which the most famous example is India setting up a sugar industry against Java, basically, through protectionist methods. This is a large sugar factory in colonial Java, and this is a sugar factory in India. Capitalists are, I think, terribly divided. I'm coming to capitalism at last. Metropolitan manufacturers, this is Jacques Marseille's argument, inefficient declining sectors essentially try to stop colonial industrialization. Entrepreneurs and dynamic sectors think of developing it, with the French thinking of Vietnam as a new Japan. This is Jacques Marseille's book, is 1984, a long time ago, and yet in many ways, perhaps it's written in French again, same problem, has had less of an impact than one might have expected. Jacques Marseille, former communist militant, also noted that workers in the West were a very important group in trying to damp down colonial industrialization in a time, of course, of growing structural unemployment. And Lenin argued in a slightly different vein, actually, that workers at home in metropolis were bribed by the distribution of surplus value. But I think Jacques Marseille raised this really interesting question as to what extent organized labor was responsible for slowing down the industrialization of the Third World. This is the Tate & Lyle Thames Sugar Refinery. Why not refine? Why do you go through all these processes except refining at source? And this is the Arnhem tin smelter of the Billiton Matsrapay, which caused great problems for the Malayan Peninsula tin smelters, which were at that time already exporting tin as 99.6% pure tin metal. So in conclusion, then, I'm really arguing against Geoffrey Williamson and saying that A, there was much more manufacturing than we thought. B, that actually his periodization is completely the wrong way around. The pre-trade period was a much better period than the decline or collapse of free trade. But I think we do need to do the spade work. We need to look at actual rates as far as possible of industrial growth in the global south. And we need to bear in mind Jacques Marseille's very provocative but important contribution on the role of Western labor. Thank you.